Welcome to the New Voices Podcast. I'm your host, Joanna Chu, here with Lynette Ong, our guest today. She is a political scientist, a China and Asia specialist now at the University of Toronto, and her work looks at the intersections between authoritarianism, contention, and economic development. Welcome, Lynette.
Thank you for having me, Joanna.
We are here today to mostly talk about your new book, Outsourcing Repression, about everyday state power in contemporary China. But like in all our podcasts, we would also like to know you a bit better as a person and your career, which has spanned Singapore, Australia, Canada now, and the US. Can you give us a little snapshot of how you got to this point of publishing several of these great books on China's political system?
Right. So I got interested in China when I was working as a private consultant in Singapore. Singapore was a bit of a gateway and a hub for multinational companies who are interested in setting up an office or investing in China. So I was part of the company that gives kind of consultancy, private consultancy to multinational firms. So after my private sector jobs, I decided to go to graduate school and then to study China properly because as an ethnic Chinese from Southeast Asia, this is part of the kind of the root seeking type of journey for me to understand myself, my family, and my roots a little bit better. So I've been studying China since late 1990s for just slightly over 20 years now. Started off with political economy. That was my background. So that was the subject of my first book about credit and fiscal system in rural China. But as I proceeded, village enterprises and industrial enterprises, those enterprises were restructuring and governments, local governments in China at that time drew increasing amount of revenue from urbanization, which is the empirical context of this book, Outsourcing Repression.
In addition to your academic publications and books, your research has been covered in a lot of major international media like New York Times, The Economist, Wall Street Journal. What were some of the main topics that you think captured the public's attention from your research in the past 20 years?
So I can speak on my areas of research expertise, that is in the area of political economy as well as authoritarianism. And quite often I see the interaction between the two because, you know, it's all an endogenous process because decisions are made and how things reinforce each other. And I think it's difficult to see them in isolation. So those are the areas which I speak regularly to the media and write about for a popular audience.
Mm-hmm. Do you think people are interested in these issues because they're interested in politics and human rights in China? Or are they also interested in how this kind of authoritarianism control works in China because there might be broader international implications?
Yeah, I think, you know, business community are interested, still interested in kind of business opportunities in China, but business opportunities cannot be studied in isolation of politics, right? And people who are interested in human rights, but, you know, decisions that affect human rights are also not made in isolation, which is really the message that I am trying to bring, that we need to understand China as a political system in order to understand different aspects and different dimensions of its governance.
So let's dive into discussing your really fascinating book, Outsourcing Repression. It's about everyday state power in contemporary China, really drawing heavily on your field on the ground research. Speaking of the people, like you mentioned, who were the subject of land grabs by the state and people who tried to resist that, and coming across these kind of non-state actors who were, you know, trying to, would you say, impose a will of the state. So when I saw the cover page of your new book that was coming out, so many images went through my mind. As a foreign journalist previously based in Beijing, I had, of course, come across many non-state actors who seemed to be on the ground enforcing government, you know, protocols. In my book, I talked about how just trying to walk outside a courtroom where a senior Chinese official was going to stand trial, I was surrounded by a group of men in tracksuits. I asked them for badges, if they had any accreditation. They had none. They were wearing just sneakers and tracksuits. Eventually, some uniformed police did come and tried to explain that they didn't want journalists covering what was happening. But who are these men who, you know, foreign journalists are very aware of, and therefore a lot of international TV and newspaper audiences are also familiar with, because they're often captured on camera in different sites around China, blocking journalists from doing our jobs, sometimes jostling and even assaulting international news crews. Personally, I haven't investigated who these people are. For some reason, this didn't come to mind, because as soon as you are working in this environment, coming across these kind of non-state thugs are kind of ubiquitous. So how did you come across this phenomenon of non-state actors? And how did you come across all these incidents where they interacted with local Chinese people?
I was interested in studying state repression, and the motivating puzzle of the book is, as we know, state repression often invites backlash and resistance, because you want to oppress people, you want to repress people, people will naturally rebel. But I think the beauty about the Chinese state is they are able to conduct repression in such a way that those typical costs of repression are very much minimized. So my book goes on to address this theoretical question. How do you conduct state repression in a way that you minimize resistance and backlash? So the empirical context is about how the state outsources repression to two major types of known state actors. One is violent, what I would call thugs for hire, and second type are the nonviolent grassroots brokers. First half of the book is about how the state outsources low-grade violence to thugs for hire. And the strategies that are commonly used are intimidation, bullying people, and trying to, you know, use some low-grade violence. But this is away from the public's eyes, in the dark alleys, in the middle of the night when people cannot actually see. It is as projected in my portrait in the book cover, this sort of what I would call thugs for hire, they are actually anonymous people. They are any, you know, Tom, Dick, or Harry, or Zhang San, Li Shi from the street. You just pull someone out. So these are people without a salaried job. They are unemployed. They are willing to sell their muscle power for money. So, you know, there are some guys who organize these people together and work for a project. Work for 6 months, 9 months, and they get paid hourly rate or daily rate. Mm-hmm. So it's actually quite distinct from, you know, Russian mafias, which are, you can call them by their names, and it's very violent. It doesn't make it to the press. An average case doesn't make it to the press. When it makes it to the press, they have gone overboard.
Can you tell us a bit more about the structure? How do these people end up getting these temporary jobs? How are they found, and how would the state try to distance their responsibility over such people?
Land grabs and housing demolition is one of those state policies where they need to done rather quickly, because they might be working with some real estate companies, and either the real estate companies or local governments would often have to borrow money to get the project done, because it requires high cost. So for expediency's sake, some of their strategies are also they are illegitimate, if not illegal. They might be demolishing houses before they have all consent of everybody, because they need to do it quickly. So when they are not able to produce papers and become illegal, they often would use informal means to get things done. And sending in thugs, thugs for hire, getting grassroots brokers to persuade people, two key strategies. So the key argument is that by using these non-state actors, the state can actually maintain an arm's length relationship with these non-state actors. So if they get into trouble, if there's kind of negative consequences, if there's a backlash and resistance, the state can actually stay away and say that I have nothing to do with these people. But if they do get things done, the state can actually claim the credit.
How are these people recruited? Who actually reaches out? You say a lot of these people are unemployed. Like, how are they found? How are they paid? Like, in cash, like in a back alley? And does the state have also a non-state actor who's more of a broker or recruiter in these roles?
So in one of the case studies, I looked at how in a village setting, a group of gangsters, they have collusive relationship with local governments. But the gangsters being hired, they might not necessarily be from the same village, because it's difficult to get someone from the same village to apply violent repression on fellow villagers. So this person might be from neighboring village who speak the same dialect but do not know the people they repress. Otherwise, they might get into some personal consequences, right? So it is by the head gangsters they are in collusion with village official, and then this head gangsters go out and recruit a bunch of people to work with local governments.
Oh, I see. So it's like, you know, gather some of your friends to do this job, and then they come in a group.
Right. These are very loose type of organization. They are not like mafia or gangsters where they have to sway their blood or things like that. No, these are people who get together when there's a job, and they are dismissed when they're out of a job.
Yeah. Okay, so in my case, in the case of many journalists, we come across these groups, but not in small villages, but in often major cities. My encounter with the largest number, it was in Tianjin outside a very high-level courthouse. And, you know, they were dressed in casual clothes that didn't look like they were like kind of shipped in from a rural area. They looked quite comfortable where they were. So how would that work in that case in like a major city involving kind of blocking foreign reporters from pretty high profile areas of reporting?
In my definition, when outsourcing repression is carried out in high profile cases, it's actually outsourcing repression done wrong. Because a typical outsourcing repression case happened at 2 a.m. in the morning in the dark, in a dark alley, which are most of the cases are like that. It's away from the public's eyes. People do not know about it. But in some cases where they want to, let's say, to intimidate a foreign journalist, and they cannot send in the state security or the police for that matter, it is still more convenient to send in a violent agent with an elusive identity. But in your case, you know, you might know that who actually sent that out. So it kind of defeats the elusive identity, right?
Yeah, and it risks exposing this practice to a wider audience. When I was in China, I left in 2018, but for example, when the Nobel Peace Prize laureate Liu Xiaobo, he was dying of liver cancer in a hospital under police custody. So many journalists of all different nationalities tried to visit him in this hospital, and you know, with cameras rolling, captured, you know, being blocked. Similarly, reporters trying to visit his wife, who was under house arrest for so many years. Cameras again rolling, but people blocking them who weren't wearing uniforms. Is there a risk, you think, that this practice now is so well known that both internationally and in China, people are aware and critical of this practice?
There's a very high-profile case that involves Chen Guangcheng. So I think when one of the Hollywood stars tried to visit Chen Guangcheng, that Hollywood star was, you know, was, I can't remember the name, he was manhandled by these gangsters, right? And again, and I think that is actually a very bad repressive strategy. It's not the outsourcing.
Oh, right. Yeah, it was Christian Bale, a Batman star at the time, was trying to visit the blind lawyer, Chen Guangcheng.
Yeah, so, you know, that is outsourcing repression done wrong. Because the very purpose of outsourcing repression is to minimize the backlash and the bad press. So if the press is there, if you send in thugs, you might as well send in the police. I would say that's outsourcing repression done wrong.
Okay. So can you give an example in your research of outsourcing repression done effectively in the context, you know, your book often stays in that context of the urbanization and the mass relocation of so many people in rural areas. You wrote in the introduction that no fewer than 50 million peasants in the countryside between 1987 and 2010 were relocated, and no country besides China has ever pulled off the spatial transformation and relocation on this scale while maintaining social stability. So clearly there are some positive examples in the sense that it was effective from the state's perspective. So could you give us a case study of that?
Right. So I think it's very important for me to talk about the non-violent strategies too, which are far more prevalent these days. So as I talked about in the book, the incidence of violent strategies have actually declined and non-violent strategies have increased over time. And that was government intention, as seen through government policy. So I did a content analysis of keywords being used by the central government and various municipal government, to what extent they want to use persuasion, carrots and sticks. So the frequency of the word related to sticks or punishment has obviously declined. So they want to promote harmonious demolition. Harmonious demolition using strategies such as, you know, sending in various type of volunteers, residents committee to persuade people, 做思想工作, thought work, that sort of very softer type of coercive strategies. So the violent strategies were more prevalent in the earlier years, such as in the late 1990s, early 2000s, and in rural areas. So in those contexts, a typical case, like I have said, would be those that are done in the middle of the night. Someone came back from work at 2 a.m. in the morning and halfway through got stopped by gangsters and say that, you know, you have not, your family hasn't signed the paper. If you don't sign, you know, just watch out for your safety or watch out for your kids' safety. That sort of intimidating words are examples of a typical case. So this is about 15 years ago. A more typical case these days about outsourcing repression would be sending in a volunteer or someone embedded within the community. So these people are mobilized by the state. They knock on someone's door and say that, you know, you have not signed the paper. Why? Do you know that, you know, your next door neighbors, they are, if you don't sign, you're going to affect them. And they have a son who's waiting to get married, and his marriage and his life is dependent on, you know, getting this compensation. So your unwillingness to sign is going to have implication on your neighbors and your friends and people in the community. So that sort of persuasion it allows the state not to use violence. And these people draw on their own social capital and neighborly relationship with the people in the community and get the job done. It's very effective, and people often do not even see it as repression.
Mm-hmm. And they might not be aware that these actors might be paid or not.
Yeah.
But often you say they are paid.
Sometimes they are paid, sometimes they are not, depending on circumstances. So this sort of doing thought work and persuasion has strong roots in China. In Maoist mm-hmm. years, you know, Cultural Revolution, the Great Leap Forward, the state has also drawn on volunteers and activists to implement state policies. They could use mm-hmm. it through ideology, firing up people's ideology and enthusiasm. These days, ideology alone is not enough. When you might need to give people some carrots. So I studied a case where people are given some early birds bonuses. So if you sign the papers, the state will give you some cash bonuses, and say mm-hmm. that if you convince an additional household, you are given another few thousand dollars of bonus. So mm-hmm. there is financial incentive to get the job done. But fundamentally, yeah. and I think these volunteers also believe that they are contributing good to the society. Mm-hmm. Right. So there's a certain degree of volunteerism involved.
And would you say that the system was really kind of became more widespread in China for the purpose of urbanization and rejuvenation of cities and villages?
None of these strategies are new in China. Mm-hmm. They are not unique to urbanization. But I think urbanization is such an ambitious scheme that I think it is used more widespread in urbanization and urban renewal type of projects than elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it's all encompassing and almost every city, every village has experienced some sort of urban renewal or land grants.
Yeah. So in Beijing, there's still an office for people to petition, to put their complaints in central government from all over the country. And, you know, from my observations, still in the mid to late, just, you know, from a few years ago, before I moved back to Canada, most of the complaints were about land grabs or illegal land grabs or people not getting enough compensation for their homes. Would you say that this issue, land grabs and, you know, compensation might be one of the main issues of tension in Chinese society right now?
I think the peak of urbanization has passed. The mm-hmm. peak came in about 2013, because there was a major economic stimulus in 2008 mm-hmm. and 2009. The central government wanted to pump prime the economy, and the construction was a big part of that. And local yeah. government borrowed a lot of money to promote urbanization and build infrastructure and convert land from agricultural use to non-agricultural use then. The peak has declined, but it has not stopped. So it's still mm-hmm. ongoing. They still have target about how many percentage of the rural population they want to turn into urban residents. So urbanization is an ongoing process. But I think the most violent, most brutal part, most, you know, we have seen the worst of it.
Hmm. Yeah. So you talked about how you were able to see that we've seen the peak of these urbanization pushes and also a decline in the use of violent street thugs to enforce urbanization. So can you tell us a bit about your research methodology and how you were able to make a lot of these conclusions? Because in your book, as someone who doesn't really understand numbers, you have these appendices where you are actually providing numbers of number of types of non-state actors or type of quasi-state actors. So can you kind of explain some of how you did your content analysis and research?
Sure. So I draw on three major sets of data. One is government regulation, government policy documents from central government, Chengdu, Zhengzhou, and Shanghai. These are the three major cities that I have actually done I've spent a lot of time, even though I visited another five cities. You know, I talked about all that in the first two chapters. So content analysis shows what government intention is, what central government wants local governments to do, or what local governments wants the everyday bureaucrats and official to implement. So very clearly, we could see that they want government officials to use less punishment and more persuasion. Okay,
so it's like the official pronouncements. But in that way, are they kind of acknowledging the use of non-state actors?
No, there's no mention of non-state actors at all. So this is overall, if we divide repressive strategies into rewards, carrots, sticks, and persuasion. So carrots have stayed the same. Sticks have declined. Mm-hmm. Persuasion has increased, right? There's also more preemptive type of strategies being stressed and less exposed punishment. So they want people to preempt protests, to resolve conflicts before it diffuse, to diffuse it before it turns into conflicts. So that's very clear from the content analysis of government regulation. Second set of data that I draw on is my team built a data set of more than 2,000 cases. This is land grabs and housing demolition conducted over 15 years and looked at strategies being used. So this is based on reporters' accounts or eyewitness accounts. People have experienced their land being grabbed or house being demolished, and they call up these human rights organizations, or they have seen their neighbors being demolished, and then they call up the organization, or reporters go on the spot and do a reporting, right? Mm-hmm. And then they have like vivid words like, you know, liumang, you know, gangsters, or whatever Chinese words that they use, or 思想工作, then you actually, non-state actors get captured in those media accounts.
And you have this, the Appendix D, you actually have numbers of types of people, like government officials, or 1,028 in that data set, FUGS 973. So was that drawn from that data your team compiled?
So, you know, FUGS was like one of the most common type of agents. They are the third type, but, you know, they are just a little bit behind government official and state security, I think. But they are the ones who were conducting the most violent type of act. You know, disruptions, threats that cause injuries, that cause death. So even though they commit a lot of violent act, I looked at when different types of agents are present, how likely is it to provoke protests, to provoke violent responses from people. The likelihood of thugs causing responses from people are very low or negative.
Yeah, why is it that low? Because I would think if some of these gangsters go overboard and really beat up someone who is well-respected in the community, that might, you know, I mean, I would be angry in that case. So
these are an average case. So an average case is very low-grade type of intimidation. So they came in and cut off utility supplies. That's the default violence strategies. 断水断电, right? If that doesn't work, they issue intimidating words. They may spray paint your house, intimidate you at 4 a.m. in the morning when you are trying to go out to work, knock on your door in the middle of the night, kicking doors, and then people get scared. That generates a lot of psychological tension. Often people would cave in by that time. This is an average violent type of strategies. But this is the sort of strategies that state agents don't carry out. They outsource it to gangsters to do that sort of job. Right. And gangsters look scary. A village official doesn't look scary. So the same sort of act carried out by gangsters is a lot more scary.
How do you keep control of these gangsters? That they will have some restraint, that they will, you know, do things like shut off electricity and not kick down a door and, you know, punch someone in the face and then trigger this wider backlash. How does the state try to retain control over people who you would think that are on the margins, who might be involved in petty crime and hard to maintain control over?
By and large, local officials, the people doing the hiring, have, I think, pretty good control over those thugs, because they would tell those people, we need people, the purpose of you, of sending you, is to get people to sign the papers, to agree with government policies. It's not to hurt people. Mm-hmm. That's not the intention. But there are rare occasions where excessive violence are being used, where people ended up hurting the elderly. So I contrast that with Chapter 4, which is case studies. So there's a way in which, so that is my third source of data. The case studies are selected after I read in the newspapers there's an occurrence of a major protest. When there's occurrence of a major protest, something has gone wrong, excessive violence has been used. And I go in there like 2 years later to talk to people. So so those are cases with bad outcome. If you contrast that, if you contrast my case studies with my statistical findings, you will see a big contrast. Statistical findings would tell you an average case what happened, which is when thugs are used, no excessive violence, no backlash and no resistance, very little resistance. But when excessive violence are being used, you get a lot of backlash.
Right. So what's an example of backlash against excessive violence? And what happened there? Did people go to jail? Was there kind of state sanctions or penalties involved?
So in Zhengzhou, where Wu Tianjun was the, I think, assistant party secretary or the mayor, he had a nickname called Yi Zimei, meaning that when he point his finger at the village would get demolished tomorrow. So under his leadership, Zhengzhou underwent a lot of urban renewal and urbanization within a couple of years. There were also a lot of casualties and a lot of death. The case studies that I described in Chapter 4 is an illustration of what is being done in Zhengzhou. And ultimately, the top leadership in the city is being taken down. He was charged with corruption. And we know that corruption is just a cover charge, right? It's just a charge that the CCP would use on you, but they ultimately want to get rid of you because you have done something wrong. And it's a bit of a scapegoating type of policies. Just like, you know, if COVID goes terribly wrong, someone will have to take the rap. If urbanization goes terribly wrong, there is casualties, then some government officials will have to take the rap.
And how about the individual, like, gangsters? Have any faced jail time themselves, or even if they were actually hired to do something that they took overboard?
Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. This is not something that I have actually studied in great detail, but if you follow the court cases, I'm sure this is there are some evidence of how the CCP will deal with them. And I think if a gangster is associated with the government officials that has been punished, I think that gangsters will get into trouble too. If local officials doesn't get into trouble, you know, the gangsters might be able to escape.
You say, you know, these practices have been happening in China for a while. What are the roots? Was this around in Mao's time with work units and things like that?
So I want to talk about the non-violent strategy, because I don't want to give you your listener the wrong impression that, you know, this book is all about thugs.
So both violent and non-violent, like, what are the roots of these practices?
The non-violent strategies involve mobilizing volunteers in the community, activists, the 积极分子, and the and what I call political brokers, that will be residence committee, the 居委会 or village committees, right? And these people are really part of society. They are very much embedded within the society. So if you think about how Great Leap Forward was implemented, it depends on these grassroots people firing up the, you know, citizens' enthusiasm to get them to produce more and contribute their labor to the state. And that sort of very Maoist strategy is revived in contemporary China, which is what I'm trying to show, and is very much alive in implementation of urbanization. As to the violent strategies, you know, during Kuomintang's years, when Kuomintang was a rather weak government, they wanted to deal with the CCP, because the CCP was their enemies back then. They had to pay the Green Gang, which was a very powerful mafia in Shanghai at that time, in order to kill a lot of communists, right? But the relationship between Kuomintang and the Green Gang is very different between the CCP and the thugs for hire that I talked about in my book. Because Kuomintang was so weak, the Green Gang could actually bargain with Kuomintang. Kuomintang had to give
they had more status
to the Green Gang to let them operate legitimate businesses. Whereas CCP is so much more powerful than thugs for hire these days. So it's more like a boss telling what the employees do, rather than that of bargaining situation.
And like you said, there's people who actually believe in the cause, and they believe that what they're doing is good for their community.
Not the thugs for hire, the volunteers,
but
the volunteers and the activists. They largely do. If you look at, you know, COVID policies, most men and women in white hazmat suits, those are state mobilized volunteers, you know, conducting mass testing and trying to control people's movement. People accept them, except when they go overboard, except when they want to separate their mothers from infants, except when they want to do something which is kind of ridiculous. Then you see people starting resisting. But at the beginning, people would you know, line up for hours to do mass testing. I don't think anyone in Toronto would actually do that.
You talk about throughout the book about how a lot of this is quite unique to China on this scale. And we saw the world looking at the extent of lockdowns in China for COVID and the way, you know, volunteers and hazmat suits and others kind of chasing down people to put them in isolation were operating. And there seemed to be this kind of surprise and kind of awe at this playing out in China. So why do you think this kind of level of non-state participation in implementing state goals, why do you think it is so unique to China?
The Chinese state has very strong state legitimacy. So even though this is an authoritarian country, the Chinese Communist Party has gone to great length to justify its repression. Yeah. Even on Xinjiang, the state would justify it as tackling terrorism, right? So there's actually a legitimate reason why we want to do these things to Xinjiang people, because they committed a lot of terrorist acts. So even though it's an authoritarian country, this is a very careful and astute authoritarian state that trying to justify every things that it does in fear of inviting resistance and backlash. I think outsourcing repression by mobilizing volunteers who are deeply embedded within the community. People trust these people because they are these people that you have been seeing for 40 years and as neighbors for all your life. You have to trust these people. And these people believe in what they do. They are then mobilized by the state to conduct persuasion. If I get one of these aunties knock on my door, I will most likely say yes if some unknown government official come and knock on my door.
You were in Canada throughout the pandemic, correct?
Yeah.
I remember calling into one of your classes, you know, virtually. So just even watching from afar how non-state actors, volunteers seem to be involved in the trying to keep control of COVID, what were some of your observations? Do you think the system has evolved in some way during COVID, or do you think the public awareness and attitude towards this mobilization has also evolved? Whether there's more positive recognition or if there's more frustration?
You mean the Chinese system?
Yeah, the Chinese system of using all of these volunteers, all of these village committees and officials. I'm thinking about people who volunteered to keep people, make sure that people didn't leave their apartments and things like that.
I think it has been largely effective until fairly recently, like 2 months ago in Shanghai, where some of the measures being used is just outright silly and nonsensical, right? You know, you're sending people with negative test results to quarantine facilities that doesn't have toilets. Of course, people are going to rebel and resist. But right before Shanghai, you know, I think the Chinese state has been able to implement zero COVID policies and enforce it because they are so good at mobilizing non-state actors, which other countries cannot do. So let's leave aside whether zero COVID has any scientific merit to it. The very capacity of the Chinese state to do that, I think, is something to talk about. And I'm not sure, you know, worthy of admiration is the word, but its capacity is unmatched by any other countries.
Right. So do you think, rather just looking at your book as, you know, this is going on in an authoritarian country, do you think it's more nuanced than that? That if done towards more positive means, mobilization of non-state actors, like, could we actually learn something from the system in democracies?
Yeah, I think it's a demonstration of what state could actually do, not through bolstering of a civil service or its bureaucratic system, but by mobilizing people that are in the society to get society to do things. So it's an expansion of state power. But this is, but this sort of expansion of state power is done so cleverly that these people being mobilized are actually part of society and trusted by the society, particularly the grassroots brokers, the volunteers, so trusted that people who are at the receiving end of repression do not see it as repression. They will generally buy in into state policies without feeling that they are actually have been oppressed and repressed. So state policies is carried out under the subject heading of harmony, harmonious demolition, which is, I think, so if you think about the Chinese government, the CCP has done so many things, but is able to maintain security, social stability to a large extent. I think that has a lot to do with it.
So, you know, in BC and other places in the West, we see celebrities getting involved in spreading messages about how to stop the spread of COVID. And I'm thinking about Ryan Reynolds, who was either paid or maybe he volunteered to do a video on social media that goes viral, urging people to, you know, mask up and don't kill grandma. Is this kind of like a Western expression of using non-state actors to advance state goals? And some people might see wearing a mask or having vaccine mandates as repression. And what do you think about that?
Trying to understand your question.
I'm just wondering if there's like a possible positive applications of learning about how China mobilizing people, but whether that might be met with a lot more controversy in democracies, even if some of these state goals might be arguably quite in the interests of people, such as their safety, rather than repression.
Yeah, and I think the extent to which mobilization of non-state actors for state purposes will be successful, the success depends on relationship between the state and the non-state actors. Which is, you know, in social science, this is called, you know, the scope condition. That is, if they can control them, buy them and control their behavior, hear them and control their behavior, or they can use influence and ideology to influence them, right? But there are cases where the two conditions would actually break down. So a contrasting case is I looked at India.
Mm.
India slums, government cannot work with slums because slums are run by slum lords, like in the movie, right? And these slum lords are mafias. They are actually very powerful because they can deliver votes of all the slum dwellers to local politicians. So the local politicians have to listen to the slum lords. And if the slum lords, if the local politicians want to get things done in the slums, they need to rely on the mafia too. So this is a case of the state wants to use non-state actors, but the state cannot actually control them, unlike in China.
Mm-hmm.
But so the relationship is being reversed. The state is then being held ransom by these mafias. Right. Right. So it's the reverse of this relationship. You can do it, but if you're not powerful enough, the mafias will turn around and control local officials.
Yeah. And you also talked about South Korea. What was the comparison there, the main differences?
So the South Korea under authoritarianism, this is pre-87, also went through a massive round of urbanization. Seoul was, a lot of slums in Seoul was demolished, bulldozed overnight in order to make way for I think, the Asian Games. And a lot of gangsters were also being sent for that purposes. But after democratization, people get together and form civil society, like housing association group, and they were able to fight for the housing rights of property owners and bargain with the state. So in Seoul these days, gangsters are still being used. Sometimes private security is being used, but their power is a lot more constrained. Because you have civil society who could rise up and check against the power of real estate companies, which are very powerful and often in collusion with the government, right? But so there's a lot of similarities between South Korea and China. The difference is China doesn't have civil society. Property rights owners, landowners cannot get together and form civil society organization and stand up against them. So all the protests, all the resistance are almost done on an atomic basis. People cannot work together and form a housing movement like we have seen in modern day in democratic South Korea or in India today.
So what could people power do to push back against some of the more negative impacts of outsourcing and repression? If you say, unions, civil society groups are either non-existent or really weak. Do some of these spontaneous street protests and village protests work? And what could work to try to reform or push back against some of the authoritarianism of this system?
At its peak, there are like more than 10,000 land protests a year. But over the last 2 decades, there's only one case that maybe an average New York Times reader of Chinese politics would have heard of, that is the Wukan case. But even the Wukan case would not be deemed successful now because Wukan residents were able to maintain some degree of success and protest for over 2 years. But Wukan is an exception. It's very close to Hong Kong and it has got diaspora throughout Guangdong as well as in Hong Kong. So by using their diaspora power through migration and things like that, they were able to organize and sustain the movement for over 2 years. But ultimately, the local government came in and clamped it down.
Yeah. Can you remind us what the Wukong villagers were pushing against?
A big plot of land was sold. And some villagers found out overnight that this plot of land was sold for a lot of money by the previous party secretary without telling anybody. Basically, he pocketed all the money and stole all the money. Yeah. So people became very angry and trying to organize themselves to bring in the new village party secretary to organize protests through diaspora power a lot of people in Hong Kong, and the main person mm-hmm. doing that was actually very savvy in IT, so is able to use yeah. social media and reach out to Chinese netizens.
Yeah, and do you think the international attention helped?
Attention helped, but a very important factor at that time was Wang Yang, a more liberal person, was in charge of Guangdong province. So people mm-hmm. have speculated that, you know, he allowed Wu Kan to happen because he wanted to show that he was a liberal person. So mm-hmm. this is pre-Xi Jinping. He wanted to show yeah. that, you know, he's a liberal reformer in order to get into his political game and political ranking.
Mm-hmm.
And international community then bring it back, bring the attention back to Wu Kan. So that has like second order effect that has also helped with its sustaining the movement.
Yeah, so that leads into one of my last questions. What could international communities, researchers, media, governments do to, you know, support some of these civil society pushbacks in China?
I would say, you know, civil society is more or less dead in China. If we want to explicitly support civil society, I think mm-hmm. by saying out loud, we are putting people yeah. in trouble. And people have been arrested because they have received grants or funding from mm-hmm. Western yeah. Communities, right? And I think those a lot of people, like a lot of gangsters these days after the Sao Hei campaign, have gone underground. It doesn't mm-hmm. mean that they have given up their resistance or they've given up their gangsters' activities. Just that I think the political environment is so bad right now, they have to take cover.
Mm-hmm.
They have to take shelter.
Even the gangsters.
You know, as with civil society now.
So that might be partly why there's less of the violent repression, because the gangsters themselves feel unsafe to operate?
Yeah, the gangsters, Xi Jinping has been trying to wipe them out, including the thugs for hire that yeah. carry out demolition. Mm-hmm. So some of them right. have, you know, turned into have what Taiwanese would call piaobai, set up a private security firm and become legitimate and legalized professional mm-hmm. who used to be
yeah,
gangsters.
What were the years you were mostly doing research on this topic?
So I started this project back in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
I finished my last field visit in 2019. So this is nearly a decade worth mm-hmm. of field.
Yeah. And from 2011 to 2019, on the ground, did things become more difficult during that time?
Yeah, things become considerably more difficult. As I talked about in the first chapter,
yeah,
you know, first half of that until about 2015, 2016, you know, I can wander around villages, cities, Chengdongchun, work into government offices, but then the second half, 2015, 2016, onwards, it became more and more difficult. Certainly, you know, yeah. not possible to visit any protest sites.
Right. For people who are their, you know, graduate studies in political science or anthropology or other fields who want to do this similar, really extensive on-the-ground research in China, do you have any advice for them to navigate this really tense environment where there is really high risk of putting sources into danger?
Yeah, I would say, you know, the days of doing this sort of research in China are gone, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying this quite genuinely, that it is no longer safe to do this sort of research anymore. So people who study contentious politics these days tend to mine data from social media, from government website, open source data, which is another type of studies. And that sort of studies are valuable yeah. for its own reason. But I don't think this sort of intensive field research to study repression and state power is possible in the foreseeable future.
Yeah. How about in less sensitive areas, like, I don't know, environment or gender studies or family studies?
Yeah, less sensitive areas, it is still possible. And I think for a Chinese citizen, if you go back to your mm-hmm. own village, to own city, through your informal network, is still able to talk to people, let's say if you live in the county level cities, your father is a businessman, you can still do some field research in your own city. But I would imagine there is a great deal of self-censorship because people are worried. Businessmen has been under attack. The state has been trying to rein in private entrepreneurship. Gangsters have been under attack too. Basically, the whole society is in retreat because the state has advanced so much in the last 5 to 7 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's why I would really strongly recommend our readers get a copy of your book, because it's almost capturing this perhaps lost opportunity to do this really extensive field research. Reading it, the political science methodology is like so there, but also it's so engaging because you were describing things you saw or that eyewitnesses were describing to you. So really, it's really a remarkable book. So congratulations on that. And thank you for joining me on the podcast to go through some of the complexity. I'm sure that we're barely rubbing the surface of the complexity and nuance in your book. So in addition to your book, for further reading, if people want to dig more into these issues and related topics, what would be your recommendations, Lynette?
I would say, read about what's happening under Putin's Russia, gangsterism. I mean, I found a lot of inspiration from reading about, violent entrepreneurship and mafias under Putin. And the sort of interaction between that and China are very different. There's almost a role reversal. So you read it for big contrast from China, right?
Yeah. Any sources in particular?
I think Mark Galeotti has a new book out on Chinese on Russian mafia. The book that I like best was published 20 years ago about violent entrepreneurs under Yeltsin, which was a very weak government, and violent entrepreneurs have to step in and really become the government and provide rule of law, enforce all sorts of services that the police and the court typically do.
Yeah, so check out our show notes. And we will include links to these two books. And how about, how do you try to take care of yourself while you're juggling being a professor? And it seems like you've had two books published in the last year. So do you have any tips on just kind of just trying to maintain that balance and productivity?
I'd like to do two things that would give me energy, which is sit down in my favorite cafe, quiet, and read a book. Often nothing to do with what I study and what I write. I also do yoga very regularly. I find that the breathing, the stretching, and hot yoga particularly re-energize me and give me a sense of perspective.
Yeah, me too. I, was really overscheduled myself the last few months, and I just, for my birthday, I was like, I'm going to sit in the cafe and read a book. And not have my phone on, and that was actually really nice, but I did end up taking a work call. So it's hard, everyone is so overcommitted these days. So thank you again for joining us, Lynette, about talking about your very, very fascinating research. Again, I urge you to get the book. And what would be the best place to get a copy?
So it was launched in Amazon.ca about a week ago. So I think Amazon.ca is available for sale now. And I'm sure Indigo would carry a copy too. Or you can order directly from Oxford University Press. But I think that you have to pay in US dollars. But, for your listeners outside Canada, Amazon is the way to go.
Okay, Amazon.
Well, yeah, thank you so much for your time, Lynette. You've been listening to the New Voices podcast with me, your host, Joanna Chu. This episode was edited by Megan Cattell, and the introduction and closing music, custom for New Voices, is by April Jew. And follow us on Twitter at NU Voices, on Instagram, New Voices Network, and Facebook under the same name. And we would like to, as always, thank our patrons, which makes this podcast possible and allows us to pay our producers. Patrons are invited to play an active role in our community, such as suggesting our upcoming fall season of the podcast. More information is available on patreon.com/wevoices. Thank you again. Until next time.